think of the long trip home? Should we have stayed at home and thought of here? Where should we be today? Is it right to be watching strangers in a play in this strangest of theaters? What childishness is it that while there's a breath of life in our bodies, we're determined to rush to see the sun the other way round? Oh, must we dream our dreams and have them too? And have we room for one more folded sunset, still quite warm?
That's an excerpt from Elizabeth Bishop's poem, Questions of Travel. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author Elizabeth Bishop has been called a poet's poet, a virtuoso of descriptive poetry, and also one of the most important American poets of the 20th century. Yet in part because she shunned the limelight, her work is not as widely known as many feel it should be. Her poems contrast home with foreign lands and find visionary worlds in ordinary objects. Joining us to explore the rich life and extraordinary poetry of Elizabeth Bishop is Lynn Keller, professor of English at the UW-Madison and author of several books, including Remaking It New, Contemporary American Poetry and the Modernist Tradition.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
The 20th century, to a great extent, seems to have been a rough one for poetry. What is it that makes Elizabeth Bishop stand out?
Well, she does stand out, and she's quite a singular figure. She doesn't really fit into any particular group of poets, although she's widely admired by poets of many stripes. And in fact, James Merrill has a nice statement about what he regards as her particular contribution. He says of her poems that they are poems some of us feel to be more wryly radiant, more touching, more unaffectedly intelligent than any written in our lifetime, which is quite a tribute from a figure like that. At a moment when confessional poetry was all the rage. And in fact, when Bishop herself was close friends with Robert Lowell, whom we associate with that movement, Bishop herself was writing work that was far more reticent and far more focused on describing the world around her, and in which her own personal experience comes through in indirect ways. And I think that's part of her distinctive contribution.
Kind of have to thank her for that.
Why do you think she's not as widely known as someone like a Robert Frost or a Langston Hughes or a what is it about her that hasn't made her into a household word?
Well, I think it is partly what you said about her not being interested in the limelight, that although her work has much of the kind of folksy quality of Frost's work, she didn't present herself in public as a folksy figure. She really tried to avoid the public at all costs. And the times when she had a public responsibility, she was at the Library of Congress, for instance, that were just sources of great misery to her because she much preferred to be the private person.
And is there a poem that if you had to pick a poem and say, here, this is Elizabeth Bishop, this captures her voice and her themes, what poem would you pull out?
Well, you know, I think it's not hard. You could choose a number of poems, but I think the poem from which I was reading as we started, called Questions of Travel, is a good one to use as a kind of typical poem, in part because it is about travel. And a great deal of her writing came from her own travels throughout the world and her own life of travel. But in this poem, and I'll read some of it, I think you get a sense of her as someone who managed to use ordinary language in a way that, of course, or the illusion of ordinary language in her work, so that her poems seem talky and they seem just conversational and she seems unpretentious and has a nice sense of humor and so forth. And that naturalness that she achieves, I think, is something that this poem captures. And it also captures some of her descriptive skill. So she begins this poem talking about the landscape around her, it's probably Brazil, as kind of excessive. There's just too much going on. So she says, there are too many waterfalls here. The crowded streams hurry too rapidly down to the sea, and the pressure of so many clouds on the mountaintops makes them spill over the sides in soft, slow motion, turning to waterfalls under our very eyes. For if those streaks, those mile-long, shiny tear stains aren't waterfalls yet, in a quick age or so, as ages go here, they probably will be. But if the streams and clouds keep traveling, traveling, the mountains look like the hulls of capsized ships, slime-hung and barnacled. There's a lot in just that opening stanza that's so characteristic of Bishop. One thing would be that last description of the mountains looking like hulls of capsized ships.
This is not your typical nature poetry,
is it? It is not, is it?
Slime and upturned ships are mountains.
Right. And you get a sense, I think, there of the danger of travel, that there's something threatening in the landscape that the mountains should look like this to her.
Yes, and there's too much of it, she tells us earlier on.
Too much.
And then the passage that you started with where it's, you know, why do we travel?
Why do we travel? One of the interesting things about her work is that it's full of questions. And as she goes on in this particular poem, she asks questions. She says, where should we be? Is it right? Those questions that I was reading before. This is often, I think, how she locates herself through questioning. But it's also a way, again, in which she creates that kind of casual persona. The poem comes across not as something finished and fixed, but something that's emerging out of a process of thought and exploration as she asks herself questions. And she will sometimes kind of revise the way in which she describes something as she's describing it, to give us that sense of the way in which her mind moves. So here she asked those questions, including the one I love with the humorous, and have we room for one more folded sunset, still quite warm, suggesting with a kind of mildly critical tone the way in which tourists sort of collect memorabilia and collect
pictures,
what they've
maybe,
seen.
Photographs, yes. And tuck them into a
Absolutely.
Book somewhere.
Absolutely. And then she goes on to say, but surely it would have been a pity not to have seen the trees along this road really exaggerated in their beauty, not to have seen them gesturing like noble pantomimists robed in pink, not to have had to stop for gas and heard the sad two-noted wooden tune of disparate wooden clogs carelessly clacking over a grease-stained filling station floor. In another country, the clogs would all be tested. Each pair would have identical pitch. And she goes on from there.
It's a very minute observation.
Absolutely. And the fact that she's saying it would have been a pity not to have seen these trees and have heard these clogs, instead of saying it would have been a pity to have missed this grand monument and not to have seen the pyramids or something like that, is utterly characteristic of Bishop, because it's in these small things that she finds meaning and value.
That would tie in, I suppose, to her being such a good conversationalist.
Yes, such a
small talk, if you want to call it that, even.
Yes, right. Small talk, or deceptively small talk,
yes,
in the way
yes.
that her the surfaces
Significant
of her poems.
Small talk.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
The surfaces of her poems are often, they don't call attention to their significance. The poems don't. You know, they seem just simple, and the way in which we find meaning in them is often sort of surprising, the way the
sort
meanings emerge.
Maybe a 20th century trait. I keep thinking of that. Other poem about the red wheelbarrow standing.
So much depends
and it's
on
just a
these
wheelbarrow
small
with a little splash of rain, yes,
right.
And somehow it becomes significant.
And how one sees it
yeah.
is obviously so important. And for her as a poet of observation, the other kind of characteristic trait of this poem, I think, has to do with the attitude toward home that emerges from it. Because at the end of this poem, she asks, is it lack of imagination that makes us come to imagine places, not just stay at home? Or could Pascal have been not entirely right about just sitting quietly in one's room? That is, that we don't need to. I guess Pascal had a kind of ascetic wish to minimize external worldliness and kind of
right,
just,
and kind of derive yeah, thought from his immediate
mental travel.
Exactly. So she goes on, continent, city, country, society, the choice is never wide and never free, and here or there, no. Should we have stayed at home, wherever that may be?
That's such a great leave it hanging ending.
And that's the end. That's the end of the poem, that sort of sense of, where is home? What would that mean to stay at home? Because she's someone for whom home is very elusive.
Can you say something about her biography and how the sense of home was, in fact, a literal question mark?
It was a literal question mark. And I think the traveling comes right out of this as well. Bishop was born in 1911. And only 8 months later, her father died, unexpectedly, suddenly died. And her mother's mental health was very fragile from then on. And when she was 4 years old, her mother had such a serious breakdown that she was placed permanently in a mental institution. And Elizabeth Bishop never saw her mother after that time. She never saw her in the institution.
And she was an only child, too.
She was an only child. And that means that almost as soon as her life began, she had lost the two people who provide for most of us our greatest sense of security in the world. And she had lost her literal home as well. Now, at first, she was cared for by her maternal grandparents who lived in a village in Nova Scotia. And this was a family that she loved. It is where she had been living with her mother after her father's death. But her wealthier paternal grandparents in Massachusetts didn't like the idea of their granddaughter growing up in what seemed to them such a backward place. So they came and got her. They saw themselves as rescuing her, and she felt kidnapped. She spent a few utterly miserable years with them, during which she became asthmatic and sickly. And then she was rescued, in a sense, by a devoted aunt in Worcester, Massachusetts. In fact, we'll get a chance to talk about the poem In the Waiting Room, in which an aunt figures prominently, probably based on that aunt of hers. So even in childhood, Elizabeth Bishop was moving around a good deal. She had already begun a life of travel. She went to Vassar College, and then shortly after graduating in 1935, she began taking extended trips abroad. And this is something that she did throughout her life. For a while, she was living sort of partly in New York and partly in Key West, Florida. And then in 1951, she set out to travel around South America. She got as far as Brazil, and she became very ill. She had a violent allergic reaction to a cashew fruit, I guess. She was visiting a Brazilian woman at the time, and once she recovered, she'd become so attached to Brazil and to the woman who was her lover for 15 years that she decided to stay in Brazil. And she stayed, as I say, for 15 years, probably the happiest period of her life. Near the end of her life, she lived again in the United States. This was after Lotta, her partner's death. She returned to the United States for a while in Seattle, and then in her last years, she settled in Boston. But it was a life of tremendous movement, and as I say, one in which the location of home was always quite uncertain. And she did struggle with alcoholism during her life as well, and periodically checked herself into institutions to deal with that or to deal with her own emotional difficulties.
You mentioned that she sort of avoided the confessional style that was current, but there are some references to her early life, or sort of allusions anyway to it. Can you say something, perhaps, or maybe read us Sistina and talk about how that maybe reflects her background?
And this is an interesting one because it's a relatively early poem. I'd say that in her work, her biography becomes clearer in the later poems. And in this early one, you can see a kind of indirect treatment of what is, in all likelihood, a reflection on or her recollections of the period after her mother's institutionalization, a period when she has no parents. So this is a Sistina. Sistina is a regular poetic form, and I think that this set form in which she has the Sistina requires certain end words be recycled in a particular order. And I think there's a way in which the form here, with its regularity, is part of the effort to control what is emotionally a very difficult situation. And the way in which it's out of control gets communicated in this poem by the way in which the child is sort of imagining tears everywhere in her environment, a kind of projection of this, so that the poem has an almost surreal quality at moments. And in fact, Bishop was quite interested in surrealism. September rain falls on the house. In the failing light, the old grandmother sits in the kitchen with the child beside the little marble stove, reading the jokes from the almanac, laughing and talking to hide her tears. She thinks that her equinoctial tears and the rain that beats on the roof of the house were both foretold by the almanac, but only known to a grandmother. The iron kettle sings to the stove. She cuts some bread and says to the child, "It's time for tea now." But the child is watching the tea kettle's small, hard tears dance like mad on the hot black stove, the way the rain must dance on the house. Tidying up, the old grandmother hangs up the clever almanac on its string. Bird-like, the almanac hovers half open above the child, hovers above the old grandmother and her teacup full of dark brown tears. She shivers and says she thinks the house feels chilly and puts more wood on the stove. "It was to be," says the marvel stove. "I know what I know," says the almanac. With crayons, the child draws a rigid house and a winding pathway. Then the child puts in a man with buttons like tears and shows it proudly to the grandmother. But secretly, while the grandmother busies herself about the stove, the little moons fall down like tears from between the pages of the almanac into the flower bed the child has carefully placed in the front of the house. "Time to plant tears," says the almanac. The grandmother sings to the marvelous stove, and the child draws another inscrutable house.
It's so beautiful and painful at the same time.
It is so painful, isn't it? This sense, home is what should not be inscrutable, right?
And so much unspoken pain.
So much unspoken. And I think that continued to be her way. We talked about her reticence, that a lot of the pain in her life was pain she did not want to speak. But then it's sort of in some ways everywhere, as it is in this poem.
But like the first poem we heard, home is not the place. It's not where she wants to be.
Yeah, or it's elusive what
so
home
is.
She
doesn't know where it is.
Yeah, where it is. And here this sad, you know, the way in which she draws in what one might imagine to be a father figure. Yeah.
Another poem that stands out for me is In the Waiting Room, where she does refer to herself by name and almost seems to be sliding off the world in terms of her identity.
Yeah. And this would be another poem that comes right out of her experience. But this one is a later poem, and she's much more direct about it being at least her experience, although the context of why, for instance, she would be with her aunt as opposed to parents or something, that's not in here. She's not going to confess that kind of unpleasant detail. One of the interesting things for me about this poem is the way in which it helps us understand why Bishop became such a descriptive poet, because she is a poet known for her amazing descriptions of the world around us. And in this poem, you see the way in which the child tries to hang on to this world and some sense of order in it and rationality by looking around her as if observation is going to provide a kind of anchor. But here, it's not enough. And she does kind of float away or perhaps lose consciousness in being just overwhelmed. So it starts out in the waiting room of a dentist's office where her aunt, probably modeled on this aunt that she lived with, is in the inner sanctum there with the dentist. So she says, "In Worcester, Massachusetts, I went with Aunt Consuelo to keep her dentist's appointment and sat and waited for her in the dentist's waiting room." So you start with something
very
so ordinary.
Yes,
entirely
ordinary.
All there with her at this
point. Although Aunt Consuelo, I want to get back to that. That's not what you'd expect in Worcester, Mass.
That's true. Yeah, and so maybe this way of kind of signaling an outsiderhood, which she probably felt in various ways all her life. "It was winter. It got dark early. The waiting room was full of grown-up people, arctics and overcoats, lamps and magazines. My aunt was inside what seemed like a long time, and while I waited, I read the National Geographic, I could read, and carefully studied the photographs. The inside of a volcano, black and full of ashes, and then it was spilling over in rivulets of fire. Osa and Martin Johnson, dressed in riding breeches, laced boots, and pith helmets. A dead man slung on a pole. Long pig, the caption said. Babies with pointed heads wound round and round with string, black naked women with necks wound round and round with wire like the necks of light bulbs. Their breasts were horrifying. I read it right straight through. I was too shy to stop. And then I looked at the cover, the yellow margins, the date, Suddenly, from inside came an "oh" of pain, Aunt Consuelo's voice, not very loud or long. I wasn't at all surprised. Even then, I knew she was a foolish, timid woman. I might have been embarrassed, but wasn't. What took me completely by surprise was that it was me, my voice, in my mouth. Without thinking at all, I was my foolish aunt. We were falling, our eyes glued to the cover of the National Geographic, February 1918. I said to myself, 3 days and you'll be 7 years old. I was saying it to stop the sensation of falling off the round-turning world into blue, cold, blue-black space. But I felt, you are an I. You are an Elizabeth. You are one of them. Why should I be one, too? I scarcely dared to look to see what it was I was. I gave a sidelong glance. I couldn't look any higher. At shadowy gray knees, trousers and skirts and boots and different pairs of hands lying under the lamps. I knew that nothing stranger had ever happened, that nothing stranger could ever happen. Why should I be my aunt or me or anyone? What similarities, boots, hands, the family voice I felt in my throat, or even the National Geographic and those awful hanging breasts, held us all together or made us all just one? How, I didn't know any word for it, how unlikely, how had I come to be here like them and overhear a cry of pain that could have got loud and worse but hadn't? The waiting room was bright and too hot. It was sliding beneath a big black wave, another and another. Then I was back in it. The war was on. Outside in Worcester, Massachusetts, were night and slush and cold, and it was still the 5th of February, 1918.
Like the other poem that you read about the stove, what you might think of as warmth is too much.
Yes, that's interesting, isn't it? Yes. Just like the travel is too much motion in the Brazilian landscape, and here, yes.
But overwhelming.
The familiarity takes on almost the note of the terrifying here. How could I be part of this?
Exactly. And I think throughout her work, there is, as literary critics have noticed, a kind of interpenetration of the ordinary and the strange and the extraordinary, and that these things are not – that within the domestic, one may have these – what sort of eruptions of the extraordinary and mysterious.
And the National Geographic is just right for doing both of those. She mentioned specifically Martin and Osa Johnson, who were very famous world explorers of the teens and 20s, and all these exotic things. And yet, in a way, it's in the most prosaic of magazines, the National Geographic, which, you know, everybody gets. It's in every dentist's office.
Yes.
It becomes that exotic becomes part of the familiar.
Although it was the first magazine in which one could see naked women.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's that.
Yes.
And so I think that there is a lot
for better or worse.
For better or worse. And there's, the issues of gender identity are clearly part of what's so overwhelming here with her horror at the breasts that she will come to have. And even the way in which Osa and Martin Johnson are both dressed in riding breeches, laced boots and pith helmets, so that we have a kind of cross-dressing on the part of the woman here that I think confuses gender identity.
And we have the date of 1918 reminding us
the war is on.
Yeah.
And so having that disjunction of the we're all one, we're all the same, what are we doing having wars? Although that question isn't raised explicitly, I think this juxtaposition of, okay, I'm back in it, the war's on, is another kind of unfathomable, unlikely juxtaposition.
Yeah. She, in that other poem that we started with, has done the same thing at the end where she really throws you a curveball. Home, wherever that is, and here, oh, by the way,
there's a war.
Right.
The great war.
Right. That's
outside.
Right. That's right. This is the only poem in her published work in which she uses her own name, Anne Elizabeth. She says, I am me, Anne Elizabeth. So the sense that here of being, how can I be this distinct individual and also be part of womankind and part of humankind, that's just so difficult, so overwhelming. But you do see her as she's trying to stop this sensation of falling off the world, trying to look around and say, okay, trousers, skirts, boots, hands and locate herself that way and throughout her work. So often, I think the descriptive emphasis is a way to try to hold on in the face sometimes of kind of threatening chaos.
More on the life and poetry of Elizabeth Bishop when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
Simply Folk, tonight at 5 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Join Tom Martin Erickson and his guest Judy Rose tonight, Simply Folk, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Dreams were the worst. Of course, I dreamed of food and love, but they were pleasant rather than otherwise. But then I'd dream of things like slitting a baby's throat, mistaking it for a baby goat. I'd have nightmares of other islands stretching away from mine, infinities of islands, islands spawning islands like frogs' eggs turning into polywogs of islands. Knowing that I had to live on each and every one eventually for ages, registering their flora, their fauna, their geography.
That's 20th century American poet Elizabeth Bishop reading from her poem Crusoe in England at the Library of Congress. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Lynn Keller, and we're exploring the poetry of Elizabeth Bishop. You know, Lynn, when I was trying to find a recording of Elizabeth Bishop reading and I listened to different poems, it seemed to me that her reading was kind of flat.
It is flat, isn't it? You know, she did not like to read in public. And again, this is part of that shyness that I talked about, this desire to avoid public attention. She really, it was painful for her to read. And I think you can sort of tell when you hear that, because she really doesn't do her work credit.
No, but it's a thrill to sort of hear her reading.
It
I think
is.
Whenever there's
it's
sort
always.
Of a major poet, it's nice to have those,
absolutely.
Those recordings.
Absolutely.
You mentioned when we were talking that one of the things that Elizabeth Bishop does is to describe things so vividly and to use that description to lead somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Can you give us another example of a poem that does that, that moves from description to sort of vision,
yeah.
I guess?
Yeah, let's talk about the fish as an example of this. And one of the things about her descriptions is often when she'll do some kind of comparison, she'll make a comparison to something that's quite of another realm than what she's actually looking at. So that as she starts to describe this fish, and I'll read it in a moment, she moves into a comparison, for instance, between his skin and wallpaper. So we move from the animal realm to the, you know, to the man-made. And often you'll see in her work also shifts of scale that make her descriptive comparisons so interesting. But anyway, this is a good one because it seems to me that in this poem, it's the very process of really looking carefully that brings about a kind of epiphany, a kind of revelation at the end, a whole different way of perceiving, in this case, the fish. And that happens in several of her poems, where it's the process of description itself that seems to lead to something really wonderful. Here, I'll just read the poem, The Fish. I caught a tremendous fish and held him beside the boat, half out of water, with my hook fast in the corner of his mouth. He didn't fight. He hadn't fought at all. He hung a grunting weight, battered and venerable and homely. Here and there, his brown skin hung in strips like ancient wallpaper, and its pattern of darker brown was like wallpaper, shapes like full-blown roses stained and lost through age. He was speckled with barnacles, fine rosettes of lime, and infested with tiny white sea lice, and underneath two or three rags of green weed hung down. While his gills were breathing in the terrible oxygen, the frightening gills, fresh and crisp with blood that can cut so badly, I thought of the coarse white flesh packed in like feathers, the big bones and the little bones, the dramatic reds and blacks of his shiny entrails, and the pink swim bladder like a big peony. I looked into his eyes, which were far larger than mine, but shallower and yellowed, the irises backed and packed with tarnished tinfoil seen through the lenses of old scratched isinglass. They shifted a little, but not to return my stare. It was more like the tipping of an object toward the light. I admired his sullen face, the mechanism of his jaw, and then I saw that from his lower lip if you could call it a lip, grim, wet, and weapon-like, hung five old pieces of fish line, or four, and a wire leader, with the swivel still attached, and all their five big hooks grown firmly in his mouth. A green line frayed at the end where he broke it, two heavier lines, and a fine black thread still crimped from the strain and snap when it broke and he got away. Like medals with their ribbons frayed and wavering, a five-haired beard of wisdom trailing from his aching jaw. I stared and stared, and victory filled up the little rented boat from the pool of bilge where oil had spread a rainbow around the rusted engine to the baler rusted orange, the sun-cracked thwarts, the oarlocks on their strings, the gunnels, until everything was rainbow, rainbow, rainbow. And I let the fish go.
She about had to, didn't she? She could not have written the poem if she'd eaten it.
That's true. But what strikes me here is that process of she starts to look at him and starts to describe this fish, and then she begins to enter more into a recognition of his real otherness, that for him the oxygen is terrible, and then that his eyes are very different from her own, that they shift a little, but not to return my stare. This is not, again, this is not your typical nature poem, a sort of communion with the animal. The animal is really other. Yes. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that it's from that acknowledging otherness and admiring it that she has this kind of revelation of victory that I think of as the fish's victory. That he's the survivor.
He's like a decorated warrior.
A decorated warrior, absolutely. But that this was something she could only appreciate by really seeing him quite apart from herself. And maybe the victory becomes her own as well as she lets the fish go and also as she is able to have this experience of wonder, of rainbow, rainbow everywhere.
Did she have a religious background that sort of influenced her poetry?
She talks about herself as a watery Baptist, I think, someplace. But I don't think
Isn't that redundant?
I don't think, maybe.
I was just
maybe.
Wondering with that reference to the rainbow, which has the biblical
right.
connotation,
yeah,
so
yeah.
whether she came out of a particular tradition or...
I don't think that I'm not aware of her as a person of tremendous religious faith, but I think she was raised in a context where she was exposed to those things. And she does make, as so many poets do, references and allusions to biblical lore.
So, my understanding is that Ernest Hemingway liked this poem quite a bit, too.
She knew Hemingway during her time in Key West. I didn't know that he liked it, but that's great since he's the great fisherman, right?
Another poem where she talks about an animal is the moose.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that one.
This is a later poem and one in which I think, well, in this poem, her sort of revelation comes from really observing something that she's deliberately focusing on. But in the moose, the animal emerges just suddenly out of nowhere. And it seems to me to suggest the ways in which moments of really gratifying revelation can occur just in life's journey. And in fact, this particular poem is very much a journey. It's literally a journey in it. I don't think we need to read it all maybe, but it starts out with a journey through... It must be the Bay of Fundy, the home of the long tides where the bay leaves the sea twice a day and takes the herring long rides. So she is in her beloved area of
Nova Scotia
mm-hmm. here. And so it's a bus journeying. It journeys through west through this landscape. She is, I think, the lone traveler who gives kisses and embraces to seven relatives while a collie supervises and gets on the bus, and the bus starts. She has absolutely gorgeous description in here where she says, "The light grows richer. The fog, shifting, salty, thin, comes closing in. Its cold, round crystals form and slide and settle in the white hen's feathers, in gray glazed cabbages, on the cabbage roses, and lupins like apostles. The sweet peas cling to their wet white string on the whitewashed fences. Bumblebees creep inside the foxgloves, and evening commences." It's a beautiful description and one that has all these soothing sounds And this particular journey seems one that involves a lot of things that are reassuring and comforting for her. In particular, in the course of this bus ride, as the passengers lie back and some of them start to sleep and so forth, she hears voices in the back of the bus that to her sound like grandparents' voices, and I presumably like the voices of her maternal grandparents in Nova Scotia. It says, grandparents' voices uninterruptedly talking in eternity, names being mentioned, things cleared up finally, what he said, what she said, who got pensioned, deaths and sicknesses, the year he remarried, the year something happened, she died in childbirth. That was the son lost when the schooner foundered. He took to drink. Yes, she went to the bad. When Amos began to pray, even in the store, and finally the family had to put him away. Yes, that peculiar affirmative. Yes, a sharp indrawn breath, half groan, half acceptance, that means life's like that. We know it. Also death. Talking the way they talked in the old feather bed, peacefully, on and on, dim lamplight in the hall, down in the kitchen, the dog tucked in her shawl. Now it's all right even to fall asleep, just as on all those nights. Suddenly the bus driver stops with a jolt, turns off his lights. A moose has come out of the impenetrable wood and stands there, looms, rather, in the middle of the road. It approaches. It sniffs at the bus's hot hood, towering, antlerless, high as a church, homely as a house, or safe as houses. A man's voice assures us, perfectly harmless. Some of the passengers exclaim in whispers, childishly, softly, sure are big creatures. It's awful plain. Look, it's a she. Taking her time, she looks the bus over, grand, otherworldly. Why do we feel? We all feel this sweet sensation of joy. Curious creatures, says our quiet driver, rolling his R's. Look at that, would you? Then he shifts gears. For a moment longer, by craning backward, the moose can be seen on the moonlit macadam. Then there's a dim smell of moose, an acrid smell of gasoline.
So she's doing the same thing again here. It's this contrast between, although it seems a shift back and forth between the familiar and the strange. She has the familiar sounds of these grandparental voices,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then suddenly this exotic moose, and we somehow seem to absorb the moose, and just as we've done that, then we have this acrid smell of gasoline, mm-hmm. Which...
Right. That's right.
...casts us apart again.
Yeah, so these epiphanies, these moments of... These gratifying moments of feeling of joy and wonder are very, very brief. You know, they disappear just like this brief vivid vision of this moose. And I think that the domestic and the strange are right there together in the moose, high as a church, which gives it that sublimity, right? Or homely as a house, mm-hmm. That somehow this moose is both those things.
Oh, they are.
And, you know, there it is, both of them. Another thing that I notice here is the way in which she uses this very flat language and treasures the vernacular, sure are big creatures, it's
right.
Awful plain, because this is the language of community. I think. This is where people come together. And she
draws us in, too, as readers, where she says, we do this. You know, this is
yes.
What we do. So it isn't just we're reading a poem about these people who see a moose, but so often she seems to sort of stop what she's doing and saying, you know, say, this is what we do.
Well, mm-hmm. The other contrast she has going there, seemed to me, is she falls into this almost hypnotic dream state, mm-hmm. Before this moose. You have all these words, fall, all.
Mm-hmm.
There are like four or five of them, and she's not what you call a rhyming poet by any means. But right before that moose shows up, you have these repeated all words. And then suddenly we go
mm-hmm.
Into the vernacular.
That's right. It's all right now, even to fall asleep just on all those nights. Mm-hmm. And
right.
We had the shawl in
yes.
The hall. That's right. You know, she is more of a rhyming poet than you'd think. Mm-hmm. She hides her rhymes. And
it's
this
there.
Is one
I've
of the interesting
it,
things
subtle,
about
yeah.
It. Yeah. So that there are ways in which she really draws on formal metrical traditions, but in a way that that seems more casual and natural. So she doesn't call attention to it, but it is there again as a kind of ordering structure in the work.
When I first read the poem, I was afraid for a moment that the moose had gotten hit by another vehicle when it said the dim smell of moose acrid smell of gasoline. So.
Oh, dear. Luckily, this one seems quite alive.
Quite alive.
The moose and the fish both got away. That's,
right.
That's two for two.
The other thing that's notable is her assertion, that confident assertion, that we all do feel this sensation of joy. She emphasizes that. Why do we feel? We all feel. So in this moment, these people on the bus, an assorted bunch of strangers.
From this homely animal. With
they're lifted, are brought together.
They're lifted away from their ordinary
life.
They
are. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Final thoughts on Elizabeth Bishop when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
When you call us, we'll listen. Wisconsin Public Radio's audience services team has knowledgeable and friendly people who are ready to help you. Call us at 800-747-7444 with your comments, questions, and suggestions.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Lynn Keller, and our topic, the poet Elizabeth Bishop, 20th century American poet of almost style that's hard to describe, hard to summarize, and one who traveled far from her non-home originally
right.
in Massachusetts or Nova Scotia and went to Brazil and had a very formative 15-year experience mm-hmm. there. Did that affect – do you think that affect her thinking, her writing, or is it just more of the same?
I think it affected it greatly. I think it was the place that was closest to home for her. And you see that particularly in a poem like Santa Rem, where she expresses a desire actually to stay someplace, which is quite unusual. Maybe I'll read to you from that poem. It begins, "Of course I may be remembering it all wrong after how many years? That golden evening, I really wanted to go no farther. More than anything else, I wanted to stay a while in that conflux of two great rivers, Tapajós, Amazon, grandly, silently flowing east. Suddenly there'd been houses, people, and lots of mongrel riverboats skittering back and forth under a sky of gorgeous underlit clouds, and everything gilded, burnished along one side, and everything bright, cheerful, casual, or so it looked. I liked the place. I liked the idea of the place. Two rivers. Hadn't two rivers sprung from the Garden of Eden? No, that was four, and they diverged. Here only two, and coming together. Even if one were tempted to literary interpretations such as life-death, right-wrong, male-female, such notions would have resolved, dissolved, straight off in that watery, dazzling dialectic."
Well, thank you, Elizabeth Bishop, for pointing the way not to interpret your poem for us.
Really,
poem and literary criticism all rolled into one.
Right. That's not the end of the poem, but I think it gives you a sense of the flavor of her deep pleasure in this place. And this particular place, because of this notion of things coming together, I think in her work there's a lot of interest in getting away from dichotomies like life versus death, right versus wrong. And in this place, she finds it embodied. She goes on and describes with great pleasure all the life in this place. And then she ends with a quite interesting passage, I think. She says, "In the blue pharmacy, the pharmacist had hung an empty wasp's nest from a shelf, small, exquisite, clean matte white, and hard as stucco. I admired it so much he gave it to me. Then my ship's whistle blew. I couldn't stay. Back on board, a fellow passenger, Mr. Swan, Dutch, a retired head of Phillips Electric, really a very nice old man who wanted to see the Amazon before he died, asked, 'What's that ugly thing?'"
That's another moose, of course.
It is. It's another moose. I mean, it's another object of unexpected great beauty. And one has to feel sorry for Mr. Swan, who's missing it, you know, who wants to see the Amazon before he dies but isn't using his eyes.
I don't want to overinterpret, but swan is a great name for a guy who says, what's that ugly thing?
Isn't it the ugly duckling? Absolutely. So there's a little joke in there. But the importance of really seeing and looking comes here as well. And it seems that Brazil was just a great place for just that.
And she must have felt that she was no longer a tourist there. Unlike Mr. Swan, she was actually part of the place and absorbing its beauty and in a way that you can't when you're trying to collect those folded sunsets.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, we have the prosaic, instead of a dentist's office this time, it's a pharmacy.
Right, that's right.
With this thing that somebody brought in from outdoors and stuck on a shelf.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I was thinking about Elizabeth Bishop a few days ago when I couldn't find my keys. You know, I've always, my whole life, ever since reading her poem, One Art, she somehow makes the act of losing your keys into something bigger than that.
Mm-hmm, she does. This is a very late poem. It's a sad poem about life as a series of losses. And here she really is using regular form, in this case the villanelle, as a way to try to, again, impose order, get a sense of control over those losses. In a villanelle, and she takes some liberties with the form, you repeat one of two lines throughout. The most famous version would be, do not go gentle into that dark night, the Dylan Thomas poem. So here we go. One art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and, vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster.
It's a wonderful way she has, again, of taking the most prosaic of losing a key and then building that in this villanelle form so that she's upping the ante with each stanza.
Absolutely, upping the ante with each stanza. And the greatest loss is the loss of love at the end, whether this is the end of a relationship or the death of someone beloved. But that's the ultimate disaster. And, of course, her assertion that it isn't hard to master and that isn't a disaster becomes increasingly force, obviously, and something that she has to tell herself, write it. You know, it's a conscious artifice. Use art to control this loss.
It really reminds me, too, of Sistina, or in the waiting room, where the child is trying to hold on.
There are
these tears, there are these, you know, scary outside worlds, but you're sort of trying to hold on. And here it's, you're almost using art, using words to try to get a grip on something
awful.
That's
right. That's right.
Elizabeth Bishop was, for a year, the poet laureate of the United States.
Yes.
Is that
she
the typical?
That.
I was going to say, that's not the typical term of office, is it? Because for a poet laureate, you're supposed to write what's called occasional poetry.
Well, was she the poet laureate? She was at the Library of Congress as the, I can't remember.
I think 1950 to 51, something like
was
that.
Was that her official title? Was it poet
laureate?
Yes, she hated
it because she had to force the poetry.
Well, the publicness of the
role. And the publicness.
Yeah, yeah. So this was something I think that Robert Lowell got for her and thought he was doing her a great favor. And she may have welcomed it too initially, I'm not sure. But then, as I say, it was kind of a torment for her. And she is someone who, you can see in this poem, that she looks back on her life with a sense of just loss after loss after loss. And this was not an easy life, although she also has poems where the sense of what art can do isn't just control disaster. Something like the poem she calls Poem seems to me to suggest maybe some more genuinely positive, well, obviously it's positive if art can control disaster, but something a little less desperate about what life can do. And in this poem, she looks at a tiny little doll painting. And in fact, I visited her apartment shortly after her, a few years after her death, and saw this little painting. And it is, just as it says, very dull and hard to see much in. It's just tiny. But again, as with the fish, she looks at it closely enough to begin to see things there that prove tremendously rewarding. About the size of an old-style dollar bill, American or Canadian, mostly the same whites, gray greens, and steel grays, this little painting, a sketch for a larger one, has never earned any money in its life. Useless and free, it has spent 70 years as a minor family relic, handed along collaterally to owners who looked at it sometimes or didn't bother to. And now what we have is she begins to look herself. It must be Nova Scotia. Only there does one see gabled wooden houses painted that awful shade of brown. The other houses, the bits that show, are white. Elm trees, low hills, a thin church steeple, that gray-blue wisp, or is it? In the foreground, a water meadow with some tiny cows, two brushstrokes each, but confidently cows, two minuscule white geese in the blue water, back-to-back feeding, and a slanting stick. Up closer, a wild iris, white and yellow, fresh squiggled from the tube. The air is fresh and cold. Cold early morning, clear as gray glass, a half inch of sky below the steel-gray storm clouds. They were the artist's specialty. A speck-like bird is flying to the left, or is it a fly speck looking like a bird? I think I'm going to stop for a moment because what's happened is she's moved from describing the paint and how the paint is applied to actually kind of entering the world of the painting when she says the air is fresh and cold. This is her imaginative entry.
Yes, a painter couldn't do that.
No, cold early spring. So she's now much more inside it. And then we have, heavens, I recognize the place. I know it. It's behind, I can almost remember the farmer's name, his barn backed on that meadow. There it is, titanium white, one dab. The hint of steeple, filaments of brush hairs barely there, must be the Presbyterian church. Would that be Miss Gillespie's house? Those particular geese and cows are naturally before my time. A sketch done in an hour, in one breath, once taken from a trunk and handed over. Would you like this? I'll probably never have room to hang these things again. Your Uncle George, no, mine, my Uncle George, he'd be your great-uncle, left them all with Mother when he went back to England. You know, he was quite famous, an R.A. I never knew him. We both knew this place, apparently, this literal small backwater. Looked at it long enough to memorize it our years apart. How strange. And it's still loved, or its memory is. It must have changed a lot. Our visions coincided. Visions is too serious a word. Our looks, two looks. Art copying from life, and life itself. Life and the memory of it so compressed they've turned into each other. Which is which? Life and the memory of it cramped, dim, on a piece of Bristol board. Dim. But how live, how touching in detail. The little that we get for free, the little of our earthly trust, not much. About the size of our abidance along with theirs. The munching cows, the iris crisp and shivering, the water still standing from spring freshets, the yet-to-be-dismantled elms, the geese. So that we are reminded that these elms will, in fact, be dismantled. Presumably that's Dutch elm disease running through the landscape.
But the line, the little that we get for free, the little of our earthly trust, could certainly apply to the poetry mm-hmm. of Elizabeth Bishop, the gift she gives us of
Absolutely.
Finding the extraordinary in the every moment.
And the sense that it may not be much, but it's enough. It's about the size of our abidance.
We have had an abidance of 1 hour. And unfortunately, it has passed us by an hour to spend with Elizabeth Bishop. But thanks, Lynn Keller, for filling us in. A wonderful world it is. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.